Caesar would have enjoyed, if only to avenge the false accusations that his country had harbored Mengele for 20 years. But almost certainly, Stroessner did not know Mengele had died. The president's close friend, Hans Rudel, was privy to the secret, although according to Rolf, he did not know exactly where Mengele had been buried. And just as the Mengele family had reached a pact with the Bossets never to disclose the death, Rudel too was bound by that oath of silence. Had Stroessner known the exact details, no amount of allegiance to Hans Rudel would have prevented him from laying to rest, once and for all, the Auschwitz ghost that had haunted his country for so long. The Nazi hunters were certain that Mengele was still alive, and that Stroessner's decision to revoke his citizenship was an elaborate plot to extend him even greater presidential protection. The first of their salvos aimed at exposing this sinister move was fired by Simon Wiesenthal. Scornful of Montanaro and the Paraguayan Supreme Court's decision, Wiesenthal said it meant nothing and offered a new $50,000 reward for Mengele's capture. He also urged Paraguay to issue another arrest warrant and offered to pay the police $10,000 for his arrest. Wiesenthal's skepticism about the Paraguayan action was shared by a group of Jewish industrialists in New York who, with the help of a prominent local Jewish spokesman, actually hatched an elaborate plot to kidnap Mengele. Word reached the group, which included one survivor of Auschwitz, that two Paraguayan intelligence officers were prepared to betray Mengele for $500,000. After several weeks' negotiations, the Paraguayans agreed to arrest Mengele when he arrived at a bank in Asunción, where he was said to come regularly. Mengele would then be taken to the Brazilian border town of Foz do Iguaçu. When his identity had been confirmed, he would be handed over to the authorities. On receipt of a telephone call from one of the industrialists, $500,000 would be transferred from a Bahamian bank to a special account for the Paraguayans. Early in November 1979, $500,000 was deposited in the Bahamian bank. When the Paraguayans were satisfied the money was there, they signaled to the New Yorkers that they were ready to move in. Two American bounty hunters, one a Vietnam veteran, traveled to Foz do Iguaçu, where they waited for news of the arrest. On November 22nd, the Americans were told by the Paraguayans that Mengele would be picked up at the bank the following day. On November 23rd, there was no sign of Mengele or the Paraguayans. Although their money was safe, the Americans had been the victims of a crude shakedown by two corrupt Paraguayan policemen. The incident showed how seriously reports of Mengele hiding in Paraguay were taken, even after his citizenship was revoked. The New York industrialists were not men given to precipitate action. Meanwhile, Wiesenthal's claims became more extreme. Mengele was hiding in a special Nazi colony in Chile. He had gone to Bolivia, but the police would not cooperate. No, he was in Uruguay. He had heart trouble and was about to give himself up to a West German embassy. He had been seen 5 times recently. His capture could happen in the next several weeks. But even Wiesenthal's vivid imagination could not match the best of the stories claiming Mengele was still alive. Early in 1981, the hunt switched to a wealthy suburb in the United States. Billboards advertising Rupert Murdoch's New York Post screamed, "Angel of Death in Westchester County." The paper was reporting the Life magazine claim that from 1978 to 1979, Mengele had lived in a private house near the Ohel Shmuel Yeshiva on Haines Road in Bedford Hills, about 30 miles north of New York City. "It's the first I've heard of it," was the laconic reaction of Alan Ryan Jr., chief of the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations. He was not the only skeptic, but the Life story did contain several genuinely interesting facts about the Mengele family's financial interests in the United States. and this brought the U.S. closer to launching its final hunt. Life reported that Mengele's nephew, Dieter, was a part owner in an American corporation, KMN International Farm Equipment Incorporated, a distributor of farm machinery. Incorporated in October 1973, the company listed Dieter as its legal representative. KMN stands for Three Equal Partners. K is for Bernhard Kroner GmbH, M is for Mengele and Sons, and N is for H. Niemeyer and Sons. Subsequent inquiries showed outlets in Arkansas and Wisconsin. Although Dieter said he sold his interest in this firm in 1982, further investigations show he retained an ownership share in another U.S. company, the BSD Farm Corporation of Delaware, founded in November 1979. The Mengele family also reportedly bought 400 acres of farmland in Greencastle, Indiana, in December 1979, valued at $1.2 million. In April 1984, there seemed to be another Mengele skeleton in America's closet. There was a report that he would have been caught by the FBI on a flying visit to Miami in 1979, but for a last-minute tip-off. This time, the source appeared to be reliable. An assistant United States attorney in Miami, Jerry Sanford, claimed he had been given the secret task of arresting Mengele at the airport after the FBI received word that he would be flying in from Asunción on board Braniff Flight 974, arriving at 6:30 a.m. on August 29, 1979. Since Sanford was running for local political office in 1984, it seemed an opportune moment to tell the electorate how close he had come to catching Mengele and how he had persisted with the hunt ever since. He chose the Jewish Floridian to break his story. On a Friday afternoon, I got a call from the Justice Department in Washington telling me that I had been selected to handle a matter of extreme delicacy. They refused to give me a name. They told me to tell no one, not even my boss, about this assignment. At 8 p.m. that night, two FBI agents arrived at Sanford's house to explain the mission. Sanford went on, "I was stunned. Suddenly it seemed as if I had lived just for this night. Then an hour later, I got a call from Washington telling me Mengele had apparently been tipped off and wouldn't be arriving. My disappointment was bitter." In fact, there had been a tip to the FBI that Mengele was flying into Miami, but it was all an elaborate hoax. Members of Paraguay's opposition political parties had made a reservation under the name Josef Mengele in the hope that the recurring image of the Angel of Death would compromise the Stroessner government. Not knowing the source of the reservation, the West Germans had picked it up and asked the FBI to check. Afterward, Sanford became convinced that Mengele might be tied up in a drug smuggling racket. As a former chief of the Drug Trafficking Prosecution Unit for the Attorney's Office in Miami, Sanford put together a chart of what he called possible links among anti-communist groups, terrorists, narcotics people, and pro-Nazi groups. Although only conjecture, his suspicion was shared by the CIA. As early as 1972, CIA reports suggested that Mengele was using the name Dr. Henrique Vollmann and lived near Encarnacion, and that he and others are heavily involved in narcotics traffic. In November 1979, the CIA again speculated that Mengele might have been involved in drug dealing. An internal memorandum was drawn up in collaboration with the Drug Enforcement Administration, but it was never made public. A CIA officer coordinating foreign narcotics intelligence said that the article, though a tantalizing bit of information, is based on very circumstantial and unsubstantiated evidence and does not warrant publication as finished intelligence. Speculative as these reports were, their effect when they were disclosed early in 1985 added to mounting congressional pressure on the United States to throw its formidable resources into the Mengele hunt. The CIA, said Senator Alphonse D'Amato, had just Let the information hang there. No one pursued this. One premise never seemed to be in doubt. Mengele was alive. Of that, everyone was sure. In Frankfurt, Hans Eberhard Klein, the prosecutor in charge of the West German investigation, said he had no reason to think Mengele was dead. But in view of the Bonn government's inaction over the years, it is difficult to know the basis for Klein's assertion. The West Germans had never inspired much confidence in their determination to exhaust all possible leads. 6 months before Mengele's death was discovered, Serge Klarsfeld, the Paris-based Nazi hunter, told Klein he believed Rolf Mengele had made a secret trip to Brazil using a false passport. Rolf's Berlin apartment had been searched by one of Klarsfeld's supporters, and Wilfried Busse's passport was found. It was stamped with a Brazilian visa. As it turned out, this was the passport that Rolf used on the first leg of his journey to Brazil in October 1977 to meet his father. But according to Klarsfeld, Prosecutor Klein showed little interest in the lead. "We gave all the information to Klein," said Klarsfeld, "but we couldn't find out what he did with it, because he always told us that anything to do with Mengele was an official secret." The Israelis were certainly convinced that Mengele was alive. A respected member of New York's Jewish community traveled to Jerusalem in late 1984 with information that suggested Mengele owned a large farm in Uruguay. There were several high-level government meetings over what seemed to be a new and decisive lead. What neither the New Yorker nor the Israeli government knew was that the two men who were the source of the information had a history of trying to sell invariably false stories about Nazis for large sums of money. These two story brokers, Saul Stensberg, a former Argentine policeman, and Herbert John, a West German journalist with shady contacts in the Nazi information business, also persuaded Parry Match and the New York Post to spend more than $50,000 on investigating the old man in Uruguay they said was Mengele. The Post sent an advance party of sleuths, who returned with pictures of the suspect on his large hacienda, which was registered in the name of Brana. For the Post, the most persuasive feature of the story was the evidence of a prostitute, who Stensberg said visited Brana once a month. From such intimate contact, the girl had learned that Senor Brana was German, and that his friends called him Doctor. A team of United States photo identification experts were asked if they thought the photographs were of Mengele. The experts were among the most eminent in their field. Dr. Ellis R. Curley, a forensic scientist who had been a consultant on the Warren Commission investigating the death of President John Kennedy, and was to be a member of the 1985 U.S. forensics team sent to Brazil to determine whether the bones at Embu were Mengele's. Peggy C. Caldwell, consultant forensic anthropologist for the Office of the Medical Examiner in New York City and a teacher at the prestigious Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Lawrence Angel, curator of physical anthropology at the Smithsonian Institution. All three experts conducted a series of independent experiments on the photographs, comparing them with verified pictures of Mengele. They made precise measurements and evaluated characteristics such as adherence of ear auricle to skull, lobular appearance and shape of forehead, obliquity of palpebral slit. Measurements and comparisons were made of the length of the nose root diameter, the length of the face, the nasal breadth of the ali, the base of the nose to the lip closure, and many other features. The results of all three independently tested samples were remarkably similar. Phony pictures had been deliberately placed in each set of pictures. Each expert rejected these. Each expert also concluded that the Brana photographs and the known pictures of Mengele were one and the same man, and they did not fudge their answers. Dr. Curley said, "The 1937 photographs, Mengele's SS pictures, and the 1985 photograph are very probably the same individual. The conclusion is based on the compatibility of most of indices, as indicated by the analysis of variance and on the high probability of 0.9505, 95%, that they are all from the same population. Dr. Angel said that in his judgment the likeness was pretty much like seeing an automobile coming down the street at about 50 feet away and saying, "That is a Mercedes." It is of that order. We ordinarily act on that kind of thing. On this comparison, I would be willing to go to court if necessary. Peggy Caldwell concluded that the 1937 and 1985 photographs were of the same individual, regardless of the difference in his age at the time the photographs were taken. She said that the dental data clinched the verdict for her. "Yes, I would sentence a man to the electric chair on the basis of this," she said. When the Israelis heard these verdicts, they sent their own men to Uruguay to check the story. At the same time, the TV networks learned of the new Mengele suspect. Fearing they might be scooped by NBC, which had shot several thousand feet of videotape of the old man washing his car, ABC approached Senor Brana directly and asked, "Are you Dr. Mengele?" The poor man spent the rest of the day trying to convince the reporter that he was not the Auschwitz doctor. After Brana introduced them to business colleagues and old friends and showed them school records, ABC was satisfied that the forensic scientists had made an enormous blunder. Nevertheless, it was West German prosecutor Klein's view that prevailed. Mengele was still alive. And reports from Europe seemed to bear this out. Two young British psychologists, Simon Jones and Kiran Ratan, researching a psychological profile of Mengele, thought they had made a breakthrough in contacting the elusive fugitive. Fritz Steinacker, the Frankfurt lawyer who acted for Mengele when he was divorced, as well as when he was stripped of his medical and anthropological doctorates, had agreed to forward their written questions through an unidentified intermediary to Mengele. Steinacker promised that in 3 months they would receive an answer directly from the doctor himself. In hindsight, it appears to be Steinacker's perverse way of having some fun with serious Mengele researchers. "You could say that on that basis, we believed Mengele was probably alive," said Jones. Steinacker was Mengele's lawyer, after all. The US government also believed Mengele was alive. They gave some credence to intelligence reports in 1984 that he had been seen in Paraguay. Slowly but inexorably, the momentum for American involvement in the Mengele hunt was gathering pace. In June 1984, in an uncharacteristically defeatist mood, Simon Wiesenthal complained that perhaps the time had passed for the hunt for Mengele. After all, when you bring an old man to court, there is natural sympathy for him, he sighed. But congressional sympathy for that argument still had some distance to run. Two crucial events at the beginning of 1985 persuaded Congress that the Josef Mengele mystery had to be cleared up once and for all, dead or alive. Chapter 20. Dust to Dust. The wind howled across the flat ice fields of southern Poland, rattling an eerie tune on the strands of wire surrounding Auschwitz before it battered the camp's grey stone blocks. Bracing themselves against the penetrating cold, a hardy group of camp survivors, some disfigured by Josef Mengele's cruel knife, held candles and retraced their steps of exactly 40 years ago to the day. It was January 27, 1985, the 40th anniversary of the camp's liberation by Soviet troops. It was also the start of a campaign by the twin survivors of Mengele's experiments to stir the conscience of governments to find Mengele at any cost. It was such a cold day that Mark Berkowitz, Mengele's former errand boy who had been injected with unknown substances so many times he lost count, was shivering despite his double sweaters and thick coat. "I don't know how we stood in roll call for hours on end," he said. "But we did, in the same weather, sometimes colder, I guess, with only a tattered shirt and a thin pair of pants." Berkowitz pointed out to his son the crematorium where the grandmother the boy never knew had been gassed. Dor Shalansky, a member of Israel's parliament and an Auschwitz survivor, said, "We know that Mengele is still alive. He must be made to pay." The event was reported on TV stations around the world. A week later, the TV crews were in Jerusalem at one of the most macabre gatherings ever held. A mock trial of Josef Mengele would hear evidence from his guinea pig survivors before a distinguished panel, chaired by Gideon Hausner, Israel's chief prosecutor at the Adolf Eichmann trial, Telford Taylor, chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg, and Simon Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal and some Israeli colleagues had resorted to this well-publicized trial in a last desperate attempt to highlight the failure of governments to run Mengele to ground. There had been some last-minute infighting between Wiesenthal and the Klarsfelds, who had wanted to be there. According to Serge Klarsfeld, Wiesenthal wanted the Nazi hunting stage to himself. "He's an egomaniac," said a slighted Klarsfeld. The event was an enormous success. For four consecutive nights, TV screens showed victims, midgets, Jewish women, twins, telling the most gruesome tales, all testifying to Mengele's unspeakable crimes. Altogether, 106 known survivors of his grotesque research were ready to take the stand. The groundwork for this new and final push had been laid the previous month when the Los Angeles-based Simon Wiesenthal Center, in a fanfare of publicity, released declassified American Army intelligence documents showing that Mengele may have been in U.S. hands in April 1947. In fact, the documents had been declassified 18 months before, but the timing of the release, the pilgrimage to Auschwitz, and the mock trial at Jerusalem was a masterly stroke of public relations planning, especially coming after the build-up of speculative stories the previous summer suggesting that Mengele might have tried to enter the U.S. and indicating the extent of Dieter Mengele's business interests there. Pressure on the U.S. government to act became irresistible. On February 6, 1985, the day the Jerusalem trial drew to a close, U.S. Attorney General William French Smith directed the Justice Department to examine every aspect of the Mengele case, and to find him. As Smith told reporters that day, "The allegations have been such, and the public interest has been such, and the notoriety of the individual has been such, that it seemed appropriate to open the investigation. We intend to be thorough. We also intend to be speedy." The scope of the inquiry was later spelled out in detail by Stephen Trott, chief attorney for the Criminal Division of the Justice Department. "It is intentionally broad and all-encompassing. It is designed to allow us to determine what, if any, contacts this government had with Mengele following the end of the war, whether he ever entered the United States, and, if so, under what circumstances, how Mengele left Europe and made his way to South America, and, finally, to locate him and bring him to justice." The department that was to coordinate the entire project was the Office of Special Investigations, which had been established by the Carter administration to hunt down and deport the hundreds of Nazi criminals who lied about their wartime crimes in order to gain entry into the United States at the end of the war, and had hidden there ever since. The task of conducting the search for Mengele was assigned to the U.S. Marshals Service. Both the OSI and the Marshals were to draw on the extensive services of the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the Defense and State Departments. In short, it was to be one of the biggest international manhunts the United States had ever undertaken. Shamed into action, the Israeli government announced 2 days later that a new attempt would be made to find Mengele. The Israeli Justice Minister, Moshe Nissim, said that a special panel composed of police, foreign affairs, and justice ministry officials would be set up to coordinate the effort. It was a tacit admission that the Mossad file on Mengele was bare, despite the request in 1977 by Prime Minister Menachem Begin for the Mossad to give Nazi hunting a higher priority than it had enjoyed since Issa Harel resigned as its chief in 1963. Begin's former press spokesman, Dan Patia, said, "I remember the Prime Minister saying this kind of criminal should be brought to justice. He did refer to Mengele in particular, and he certainly wanted his case looked into. His view was that major criminals like this should not only not be free, but that younger generations should be educated by a trial not to forget." In fact, one Mossad case officer had been keeping no more than a watching brief on the Mengele case since 1980. Some abortive inquiries were made that year in Gunzburg, but that was the extent of the Israeli intelligence activity. A former senior Mossad agent who knows the Mengele case officer said, "He's a nice boy, but he only speaks Hebrew. Without German and Spanish, one can't get far on the Mengele case. He hasn't learned a thing. Mengele was treated like 500 other jobs, no more." The Israeli announcement was followed by unprecedented reward offers from both the Jerusalem and Bonn governments. West Germany increased its bounty from 25,000 to 1 million marks, $330,000. The Israeli government offered a staggering $1 million. The private Nazi hunters followed on an equally grand scale. The Simon Wiesenthal Center offered $1 million from anonymous contributors. The Washington Times, owned by the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, matched it with $1 million. Tuvia Friedman of the Haifa Nazi Crimes Documentation Center offered $100,000, and Serge and Beata Klarsfeld pledged $25,000. The terms of Sun Myung Moon's reward were so strict as to make it seem a publicity stunt. The successful applicant had to send in a coded 6-number, double-copied letter, giving the story to the paper first with very precise information that would lead directly to Mengele's capture. Then Mengele had to be tried and convicted of a war crime before any money was paid. The Wiesenthal Center reward only appeared to be $1 million. If anyone successfully pinpointed Mengele and gave the information first to the center, they would receive only $333,000, the other $666,000 being split between the center itself and outlets for Jewish education. The German and Israeli offers were restricted. Mengele had to be tried only in the country offering the reward. Tuvia Friedman's offer was valid only if he received the information before anyone else. Apparently, only the Klarsfelds were offering a no-strings-attached grant for the fugitive, dead or alive. Suddenly, the Mengele story seemed to have a life of its own. From this point, until long after Mengele's bones were found, scarcely a day passed without one of the three American TV networks presenting a progress report on the hunt for the Angel of Death. The networks spent vast sums of money dispatching crews to Paraguay and Europe. Magazines and newspapers followed in their wake. The New York Times assigned Ralph Blumenthal, one of their most respected investigative journalists, to the story full-time. The resourceful John Martin of ABC News also made several important news breaks. Though he could not know it then, one of Martin's most significant contributions was an interview with Mengele's nephew, Dieter. It was the first time any member of the Mengele family had agreed to be interviewed. Owning approximately $3.5 million worth of shares in Mengele & Sons in Gunzburg, Dieter is the wealthiest of all the clan. And although he and Karl Heinz jointly run the firm, Dieter has the final say in all the important decisions because he controls a clear majority of the voting shares. Dieter had watched with alarm as the new surge of activity put the family secret in greater danger of exposure than ever before. With such vast sums offered, he could no longer be sure that one of the dozens of people privy to the secret in Gunzburg and Sao Paulo might not break ranks and try to claim some of the reward, even if information about a dead man did not fall strictly within most of the reward conditions. Business was also suffering from association with the name. Dieter persuaded Karl Heinz that the time had come to leak the news of their uncle's death. The question was, how? They decided that the news had to be delivered in a way that would leave it unclear that the family had certain knowledge of Mengele's fate. At the same time, it had to have enough authority to be believed. The leak had to be controlled. Information had to seem informed but speculative. The two cousins hoped the result would be to curtail the search on the assumption that Mengele was indeed dead, while avoiding a detailed inquisition of where he had lived and exactly who had protected him. This time, they hoped, the story would fade away forever. Of the two cousins, Dieter was the obvious partner to give the interview. Having lived as a teenager with his fugitive uncle in Buenos Aires for 3 years, Karl Heinz was vulnerable to some embarrassing questions that might detract from the purpose of persuading the world that Mengele was dead. But the cousins' strategy was flawed from the start. They failed to understand that for Mengele's victims, as for most civilized people, nothing less than absolute proof of his death would be satisfactory. The interview was conducted in the Mengele Company boardroom, directly under the large oil portraits of Carl Sr., Alois, and Carl Jr. When John Martin asked if he could interview Karl Heinz too, Dieter replied, "Well, first of all, he's not here today. Second thing is, he doesn't speak English. And third, this is the main point, because he was living with, for a couple of years, with the man, he doesn't know what his feelings are. So his main feelings are the same as mine, but for him, it's very difficult for him to express himself on this special matter." The controlled leak about his uncle's death emerged like this. Martin, do you think he's survived? Mengele, I think till now, I think he's dead. Martin, you think he's dead? Mengele, he's dead. Martin, why? Why do you think that? Mengele, first of all, he's 74. Martin, 74 on Saturday. Mengele, okay, and there are so many people looking for him. I don't think that, if it's true what I'm reading, that everybody's looking after him, they would have found him if he's still alive. And for instance, my grandfather, when he was 75, he died. My uncle was 49 when he died, and my father was 60, so, you see, we are not so very healthy. Martin, but, Mengele, but I think this could be taken out. Martin, okay, I'll take that part out. But don't you think you would know, someone would tell you? They know you, they know the family. Wouldn't they tell you if they found he was dead? Mengele, you see, we have no connection. We have no connection after 1960 with him. So we don't know who, with whom, he's in contact. Sensing Martin's disbelief, Dieter tried to make his point a second time. I really must say once more, I think he's dead. If people want to know this or not, that is my feeling. Dieter dissembled throughout the interview. He denied that Mengele ever received financial or other assistance from the company or the family. But his most blatant lie came in answer to a question about whether he or Karl Heinz had ever received letters from Mengele. Mengele had, of course, sent many letters to Karl Heinz, and in a letter he sent to Rolf in 1974, he complained that Dieter had not answered my sympathy cards on the death of his father and his mother. All these details were naturally unknown to Martin at the time, but he correctly guessed that there must have been some correspondence, and pressed home the point. Martin, in all this time, never a postcard, never a letter, never any contact from him to you? Mengele, not that I know of. Martin, or to Karl Heinz, to his former stepson? Mengele, no, probably to my father, Alois, or I have no idea, but not to Karl Heinz, and not to me." The interview raised more questions than it answered. There was a clear conflict between Dieter's hint that his uncle was dead and prosecutor Hans Eberhard Klein's assertion that he was alive. The American OSI also believed he was alive. Since the Mengeles had an inherent credibility problem accrued over 4 decades of silence, the verdict swung behind the West Germans and the Americans. For Dieter and Karl Heinz, it was back to square one. On March 23rd, Rolf was asked to join Dieter and Karl Heinz for a meeting in Günzburg to discuss the next move. Dieter apologized to Rolf, who was angry at not being consulted or even notified before Dieter's ABC interview. "I tried to get you before the interview," Dieter lied, "but I could not reach you. I had to make a quick decision because it was very bad here. They had television cameras at the factory and all. But don't worry, I have kept our little secret." The little secret referred to the Mengele family agreement not to disclose Josef's death. This time, Dieter did not beat about the bush, however, as Rolf explained. He said he didn't want to live with this anymore. It was bad for business, and we should get it over with. He said that it would come up again in 10 years' time when there was the 50th anniversary of Auschwitz. He was also worried about the safety of his daughter, in that someone might try to hurt her. Dieter wanted the story leaked out, but he didn't want an announcement or anything that would tie the family into having helped my father. At the Günzburg meeting, Karl Heinz favored another attempt at a controlled leak, but he was worried about the Bossets, Stammers, and Sedlmeier being compromised. Dieter's solution was a macabre and harebrained scheme. He suggested that Mengele's bones should be collected from Sao Paulo and dumped at the door of Prosecutor Klein's office in Frankfurt with an anonymous note saying, "These are the remains of Josef Mengele." Rolf ruled that out straight away. I said, "And who's going to go and get the bones?" "Me, I suppose, because it was my father." "No, thanks." Rolf was opposed to any leak, arguing that protecting the security of those who had helped his father was paramount. "After the Bossets and Sedlmeier die, then we can disclose it," he told his cousins. As Mengele's son, it was Rolf's view that ultimately prevailed. In Bonn, meanwhile, 3 clues to Mengele's death were buried in the files of prosecutor Hans Eberhard Klein's office. The first was the lead that Klarsfeld had given him late in 1984, suggesting that Rolf had made a trip to Brazil on a false passport in 1977. The second was an intercepted letter from a German identified as Gerd Luck in Paraguay to a prisoner in West Germany, Manfred Roeder, leader of a neo-Nazi movement called the German Action Group. Roeder was serving a 13-year sentence for bomb attacks on immigrants. Letters to prisoners are read by the authorities as a matter of course. Luck's letter reported that the uncle had died on a Brazilian beach. Suspecting that this might be a reference to Mengele, the West Germans contacted their Brazilian counterparts and asked if they could shed any light on the message. The Brazilian response was not very helpful. "Which beach?" an official was said to have replied. "We've got 10,000 miles of beach." Since the West Germans did not pursue their hunch by trying to locate Luck in Paraguay, the clue was not given the significance it deserved. Nothing was done for several months. The third clue was the evidence of a West German university professor. While on holiday at Münsterthal in the late autumn of 1984, he had joined Sedlmeier and his wife, Renata, for dinner at the Spielweg Hotel. During the course of an animated conversation, oiled by brandy and wine, Sedlmeier let slip that he had sent Mengele money over the years. The professor, from Gießen, passed the information to the police. "I guess he," Sedlmeier, "felt that since my father had been dead for 5 years, it didn't really matter anymore," said Rolf. "He just let his guard drop." Of the 3 clues, it was the professor's that was clearly the most significant. Klein had always suspected Sedlmeyer to be intimately involved in sheltering Mengele, but this had never been proved, though how hard the West Germans tried is open to doubt. A police raid in 1964 on Sedlmeyer's Gunzberg house had drawn a blank. A statement from Sedlmeyer in 1971 had been a stream of falsehoods. On both these occasions, Sedlmeyer had been well prepared, having been tipped off by a policeman friend. As a result of the professor's tip, Sedlmeyer had been questioned a third time in December 1984. But again, he had given away nothing except an admission that he had seen Mengele in Brazil in 1962. He certainly did not tell Klein that Mengele had died. In the absence of harder evidence, Klein said that he had been impotent to move against Sedlmeyer. By the end of 1984, the West Germans were no nearer to solving the Mengele mystery than they had ever been. It was at this point the investigation received the important boost it so desperately needed. At the instigation of the Americans, the Israelis and the West Germans agreed to share their intelligence on the hunt. This unique arrangement gave new hope to those who were afraid that Mengele was either dead or never would be caught. It moved the normally cautious Klein to say, "I'm sure he's alive, and I'm confident he'll be caught." Neil Scheer, director of the Office of Special Investigations, the most senior American actively engaged in the hunt, echoed Klein's optimism. "Yes, I think we'll get him," he said. "I'm 99% sure of that." On May 10, 1985, 15 representatives from the three governments convened in Frankfurt for a conference to formalize their new joint effort. The meeting was more symbolic than substantive, since all the major details had been agreed upon before. The teams included some high-powered figures, Assistant Attorney Generals from Washington and Jerusalem, the Assistant Director of the U.S. Marshals, and the Commissioner of the West German Criminal Police. Klein chaired the meeting, since the search for Mengele had been principally a West German responsibility. He was anxious to take the lead. In that sense, the new coordinated effort and the fear of being outflanked by the Americans had given Bonn a much-needed prod. Although Klein chose not to disclose the professor's tip about Sedlmeyer's drunken indiscretion, he did announce that a warrant would be sought to search his house. With the Americans new to the Mengele hunt, and the Israelis' total commitment represented by the agreeable but part-time police superintendent Menachem Rusek, it had not been difficult for the West Germans to seize the initiative. The prosecutor's attempt to persuade a judge to issue a search warrant on the basis of the professor's evidence failed at first. But when they returned a second time with the intercepted letter from Gerd Luck, they succeeded. 6,000 miles away, the trail was getting warmer too. From Paraguay came the first hint that Mengele may indeed have died. The irony was that it occurred right under the noses of Beate Klarsfeld and an American TV crew while they were trying to pick up Mengele's lost trail. On May 24th, CBS's crew for their 60 Minutes program came across an old man named Alphonse Dix in southern Paraguay. What this 65-year-old photographer and farmer told producer Barry Lando would have given him his biggest scoop ever had he believed it. Dix said that several years before, Alban Krug had told him that Mengele had died in a swimming accident in Brazil. Dix also said he had taken many photographs of Mengele while he lived briefly with Krug in Paraguay. After Krug heard of Mengele's death, he asked Dix to destroy the photographs and negatives. This Dix dutifully did. To Lando and his crew, it was just one more uncheckable but probably dubious story, like many then rampant in that part of Paraguay. Nevertheless, the following day, Dix's claim was reported in the pro-government newspaper, Hoy, as Beate Klarsfeld prepared to leave after publicly accusing President Stroessner of shielding Mengele. Like Lando, she also believed the story was simply untrue. At the same time, back in Frankfurt, armed with their new search warrant, the federal police were about to raid Sedlmeier's house at No. 3 Nordstrasse in Günzburg. On Friday, May 31st, when they were sure that he and his wife were at home, the police moved in. On this occasion, Sedlmeier had no advance warning from his police informant friend, and the search party had the advantage of surprise. This time, it had gone too high in the police. No one could help Sedlmeier, commented Rolf. I don't think the local police even knew about the raid. The police conducted a thorough and businesslike search. At one stage, Sedlmeier tried to make a dash for a jacket hanging in a closet, but an officer got there first and found an address book containing some telephone numbers and addresses in code. A further search uncovered photocopies of letters to and from Mengele that Sedlmeier thought had been destroyed. To Sedlmeier's anguish and astonishment, his wife, a close friend of Mengele's before the war, had hidden them in her wardrobe. "How could you do that?" came Sedlmeier's anguished cry. "Oh my God, what an idiot!" Sedlmeier was placed under house arrest while the police tried to decode the addresses and telephone numbers. He refused to talk or give any information. But already the police suspected that Mengele was dead, because one of the letters they found was the one from Wolfram Bossert announcing, "With deep sorrow, the death of our common friend." Although some telephone numbers had no country or city dialing code, within hours the police established that other entries related to Sao Paulo. The Brazilian authorities were immediately notified. The man who took charge of the investigation in Sao Paulo was the city's police chief, Romeu Tuma, a stocky 53-year-old law graduate of Arab extraction. He had risen quickly through the ranks to become the feared chief of the Secret Service in 1972. In March 1983, he was appointed superintendent of the Sao Paulo police. Tuma had run one previous big Nazi fugitive case. In 1978, he arrested Gustav Wagner, the Austrian deputy commandant of the Sobibor extermination camp, who had lived peacefully in Sao Paulo since 1952. Wagner had organized the construction of a crude but efficient killing center, utilizing carbon monoxide fumes from a captured Soviet tank. It claimed 250,000 victims over a 15-month period. Wagner was also reported to have taken special pleasure in killing people brutally with his own hands. The capture of Wagner was prestigious and attracted media interest. Tuma, an engaging and approachable man, enjoyed the attention. This time, the message from Bonn presaged an even bigger event. Tuma's inquiries centered on two addresses. One was listed as Guararapes 650. There was no such number for that street. But the point where it would have been was directly intersected by Missouri Street. The residents of No. 7 were an Austrian couple, Wolfram and Lisa Lotta Bossert. Finding the Stammers was easier. Sedlmeier's address book listed what looked like a post office box, CP7448. It was registered in the name of Geyser and Gita Stammer. Tuma immediately dispatched surveillance units to the homes of the Bossets and the Stammers. For 4 days, his men maintained a 24-hour watch on both houses. When no one resembling Mengele's description was seen, the Bossets' house was raided. Inside, they found Wolfram and Lisa Lotta Bossert, their two children, and a Mengele shrine. Remnants of his personal effects, some writings, and dozens of photographs were perfectly preserved in one cupboard. All had been held back from Rolf on his 1979 trip to collect his father's personal estate. Among the papers was a semi-autobiographical essay with a Latin title, Fiat Lux, or Let There Be Light, written by Mengele when he lived on the Fisher's farm near Rosenheim after the war. Another essay was headed Verbum Compositum, or Collected Work, aptly described by the New York Times as a collection of harebrained scribblings on evolution. The police also found a 1983 Christmas card addressed to the Bossetts from Rolf, with a picture of him with his wife, Almut, and their young daughter. The West German authorities dispatched two German officers from the Federal Criminal Police, the LKA, to assist in the investigation. At first, the Bossetts claimed they did not know that their friend's name was Mengele. They maintained that he was Peter Hochblicker from Switzerland. The couple was interviewed together by non-German interrogators. Lisa Lotter constantly interrupted her husband in German when she thought he was about to give any compromising answers. But after 2 hours, they ended the charade. The Bossetts told the Brazilian police that Mengele's remains could be found in a hillside cemetery at Embu, 25 miles from Sao Paulo. "I didn't think you could find us so quickly," admitted Wolfram. The following day, Gita Stammer was brought in for questioning. Her husband, Geza, was heading for Singapore on board a tanker captained by one of his sons, an officer in the Brazilian Merchant Marine. Gita Stammer proved to be much tougher to crack than either of the Bossetts. She claimed total ignorance of Mengele. Tumar's men did not get one truthful word out of her during her day in custody. Word of the breakthrough had by now leaked out to the German newspaper Die Welt. On Thursday, June 6th, the paper reported that the body of Mengele had almost certainly been found in Brazil. The Americans and Israelis, who had pledged total cooperation just 3 weeks earlier in Frankfurt, were furious when they learned of this sensational news from early morning broadcasts reporting the Die Welt story. What further angered the Americans was Bonn's relaxed response to the whole affair. Quickly brought up to date by telephone, the Americans urged their German colleagues to interview Gerd Luck, the Paraguayan who was the original source of information that the uncle had died. Klein's office said there was no hurry. Luck was due to arrive from Paraguay in 4 weeks and could be interviewed then. Neil Scheer, the American OSI chief, returned to his Washington office from a Boston awards ceremony, the great fanfare that had launched the U.S. hunt 3 months earlier still ringing in his ears. "If we were the ones who had made the breakthrough, we would have shared it with the other countries before going public," said a chagrined Scheer. It had begun to look as if the West Germans had stolen the show. Senator Alphonse D'Amato, who had been so vocal in getting the hunt started, certainly felt it looked that way. He asked Scheer rhetorically when he was planning to join his German colleagues in Brazil. That night, Scheer boarded a jet at Kennedy Airport. "We're going with a healthy degree of skepticism," he said. Off the record, his staff was highly skeptical. "Our intelligence reports suggest he's still alive," said an OSI official. "There's every sign that he was seen recently." Simon Wiesenthal, who coincidentally flew into New York's Kennedy Airport for a lecture tour commencing that Thursday afternoon, said the story was a hoax. 99% it's not him," was his seasoned view. It was vintage Wiesenthal. "This is Mengele's seventh death. Only in Paraguay has he been dead 3 times, always with witnesses who say it is him. On one of these occasions, we found the body of a woman. If Mengele really died, then the whole world would have been informed 5 minutes after, not 5 years. His wife, children, relatives, besides friends and sympathizers, would have done everything to announce the death of Mengele, so they could spend the rest of their lives in peace." In hindsight, the statement shows just how little Wiesenthal ever really knew about the inner machinations of the Gunzburg clan. But Wiesenthal was by no means alone. Most Mengele experts agreed initially, the authors included. Beate Klarsfeld, who had just returned from Paraguay, where only days before she had accused Strassner of shielding Mengele, said, Alfredo Stroessner's government had every interest in informing the world of Mengele's death if it was true. This way, the country would be free of the image of a sanctuary for Nazis. It's strange that this would have come to light when there is a record of $3.4 million to whoever gives information leading to Mengele's capture. Moreover, Stroessner has a trip prepared for July to West Germany. It's understandable that he's trying to rid himself of Mengele before this visit. Unknown to Beate Klarsfeld, Stroessner had already cancelled his trip. No public explanation was offered. The information was passed on in a confidential diplomatic note to the West German ambassador in Asunción, Konrad Gacher. But it was obvious that as long as the fate of Mengele remained a mystery, any Stroessner trip to West Germany would be transformed from a state visit into a television inquisition about Mengele. Meanwhile, at the hillside cemetery in Embu, a circus of TV cameras, photographers, onlookers, policemen, and ghouls had gathered. Wolfram and Lieselotte Bossert stood stonily by the side of Police Chief Tuma, whose shiny black suit shimmered in the bright autumn sun. The Bossets were there to ensure that the right grave was opened. For nearly an hour, three gravediggers with picks and shovels burrowed 4 feet down before they struck the coffin. Its top was stuck, and the police ordered one of the gravediggers to smash it open. His pick shattered the wooden lid, revealing shreds of clothing and mud-colored bones. Mengele's arms had been placed at his side, the traditional burial pose for SS men, instead of with hands crossed over the breast, as is the Brazilian custom. Bending down over the open grave, Dr. José Antonio de Mello, assistant director of the police forensic laboratory, picked up the skull, then held it high for what surely was one of the world's most grisly photographs. Glancing at the teeth, he observed that they had been recently treated, and he said the body was quite well preserved. "We should be able to identify the race, height, and color without much difficulty," he said. Then the bones were haphazardly dumped into a white plastic tub and taken to a laboratory where they were placed under armed guard. The interrogation of Gita Stammer continued after the exhumation, and slowly she began to break. "We had to pull it out hair by hair," said one official. She told the police that Wolfgang Gerhardt had introduced Mengele to them and that he had admitted his identity 2 years later. Slowly, the pieces were coming together, though the Israelis remained skeptical. A spokesman for the Israeli consulate in Sao Paulo said his government had decided not to send a representative. Police Superintendent Menachem Rusek, heading the Israeli hunt, said he thought the incident was an elaborate smokescreen put up by Mengele's family to allow him to live the last few years of his life in peace. "He must be feeling himself cornered now," said Rusek. "He knows the American, German, and Israeli police are cooperating, and the circle around him is closing. Issa Harel, former Mossad chief, whose two efforts to kidnap Mengele had failed, was blunter still. I view all stories from Brazil with great skepticism." Only forensic science could rule out a hoax, and there were doubts that even that would produce a definitive answer. Identification techniques had advanced to an ultra-sophisticated state, but in Mengele's case, one vital clue for identifying skeletons was absent. Dental x-rays, as reliable as fingerprints, did not exist. A formidable team of experts was being assembled. Three forensic scientists were sent to Sao Paulo on behalf of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Dr. John Fitzpatrick, acting chairman of the Department of Radiology, Cook County Hospital, Chicago, Dr. Leslie Lukash, chief medical examiner, Nassau County, New York, and Dr. Clyde Colling Snow, forensic anthropological consultant, Oklahoma State Medical Examiner's Office, Oklahoma City. Three more were sent on behalf of the Department of Justice and the U.S. Marshal's Office. Dr. Ali Hameli, chief medical examiner of the Forensic Science Laboratory, State of Delaware, Dr. Ellis Curley, Department of Anthropology, University of Maryland, and Dr. Lowell Levine, Forensic Odontology Consultant, Huntington Station, New York. Their task was to see how known physical characteristics and verified photographs of Mengele compared with the remains found at Embu. For the skull comparison, a process called electronic superposition was used. It involved the use of two video cameras and a video mixer to superimpose what was left of the skull onto a full-scale verified photograph of Mengele's head. The team also managed to find a partial fingerprint and graying hairs from the back of the head from which they hoped to be able to discover the skeleton's blood type. A few clues could also be salvaged from Mengele's medical records in his SS file. He had broken a finger bone in his left hand and also suffered from osteomyelitis as a boy. None of the individual clues would be decisive in itself. Collectively, however, they could be significant. For one brief weekend, the skeptics held their ground. A Sao Paulo dentist, Maria Helena Bueno Vieira de Castro, said that according to her records, she treated the old man whose photograph appeared in the Brazilian newspapers during March or April 1979, 2 or 3 months after Mengele was supposed to have died. Moreover, Arnaldo Santana, the housekeeper who worked at the back of the Bossetts beach house, said that when he saw the body on the beach, there was no moustache. No one who knew Mengele in Sao Paulo could remember him ever without a moustache. Then there was the coroner, Dr. Jaime Edson Mendonça, who had signed the death certificate. How could such an experienced man fail to have noticed that the body he examined under the name of Wolfgang Gerhardt was 6 inches shorter and much older than the 53 years listed on the identity card? Finally, a leading plastic surgeon, Roberto Farina, told the Associated Press that the archive shots of Mengele showed substantial differences from those that the police had released for publication in the newspapers. There was even a rumor that the gravedigger, Gino Carita, had seen the body in the coffin after all, and he had recognized it as the real Wolfgang Gerhardt from his previous visit. One by one, these arguments were broken down. The dentist was not certain of her facts when questioned by the police. There had been a mix-up in her records. Santana was wrong, since moustache hairs were found on the corpse. The coroner, on his own admission, had not given the corpse a very thorough examination. The plastic surgeon had simply made a mistake. The gravedigger was challenged by Lisa Lotta Bossert, who said that her fake crying fit ensured that nobody would open the coffin. She had seen it covered in the grave. Within a week, even Wiesenthal had changed his tune. "I think it's 50-50, it's him," he said. One person in a position to provide proof of Mengele's death was his son, Rolf. But Rolf had no idea of what had been happening. He was on holiday with his wife and child, touring in Spain in a motorhome, cut off from newspapers and TV for nearly 2 weeks. Without a set itinerary, the Mengele family had no way to contact him. On Friday evening, June 7th, Rolf returned to his home in Freiburg, switched on the television, and saw the late news. From the reports coming out of Brazil, he knew that his father's secret was out. "I thought to myself, this is serious. I thought that Dieter must have leaked the story. We had all had an agreement that none of us would act without consulting the others, so I was a little surprised. The last time we met in March, Dieter had been very anxious to get the story out, but without involving the Stammers or the Bossetts or the family at this end. So I thought not only had Dieter leaked it, but that it had all gone wrong." A message on Rolf's dining table from the housekeeper said that Dieter had been telephoning repeatedly. A telephone call quickly established that Dieter was not the source of the break. With the story quickly disseminating, the question was how best to repair the damage. A crew from NBC had camped outside Rolf's house, and newspaper reporters were knocking on his door and telephoning his office non-stop. Rolf proposed to Dieter and Karl Heinz that the family make a statement.
"I didn't see how we could avoid it anymore," said Rolf. "The Stammers were talking, the Bossets were talking. It would all come out sooner or later."
But Dieter and Karl Heinz refused to make a statement, in a final but vain attempt to conceal their past links with their uncle.
"Everyone in Gunzburg was just paralyzed. No one had known what to do," said Rolf. "They had been so paralyzed that no one had even telephoned the Bossets or the Stammers after the raid on Sedlmeyer's house to warn them that the police might raid their houses."
For advice on how to handle the press, Rolf turned to a journalist friend of his secretary, Sabine Hackenjus, who had just married his stepbrother, Jens. He was Herbert Bauermeister, a freelance reporter who had known Sabine from her days as a Munich socialite. Bauermeister advised Rolf to clear the air. Rolf agreed that some explanation was needed, but he also saw the chance to make a handsome sum of money. On Sunday, June 9th, he telephoned Stern magazine, pretending to be his stepbrother, Jens, and offered letters, diaries, and photographs of Mengele. Rolf got nowhere because he was asked to phone several senior editors at home. Since none was there that night, he gave up trying. Bauermeister then advised Rolf to try Bunte magazine in Munich. He knew some of its staff and vouched for their integrity. Bauermeister also advised Mengele to forget about trying to make money. Instead, he should donate the material to Bunte on condition that profits and magazine rights from their vastly increased circulation would be donated to the victims of concentration camps. That night, Monday, June 10th, Rolf met with senior Bunte executives in the Black Forest and agreed to terms. The following day, he issued a statement admitting that he had gone to Brazil in 1979 to confirm the circumstances of my father's death, and that he had stayed silent until then, out of consideration for the people who were in contact with my father for the last 30 years. Rolf's decision to disclose details of the family's contact with Mengele throughout his fugitive life opened a wound between his mother's side of the family and the Gunzburgers that has yet to heal. Rolf explained,
"Dieter and Karl Heinz were totally opposed to an announcement, and they particularly objected to me going public with Bunte. Their position still was that the family should not be tied to this in any way. In the end, they said, 'Okay, do it your way, but whatever you do, do not involve us and the firm.' So at that stage, particularly because I respected what Karl Heinz and Sedlmeyer had done for my father, I did not then disclose the extent of their involvement."
Thus, no mention was made of the 5 round-trip plane trips Sedlmeyer had made at the company's expense, disguised on the accounts. Sedlmeyer was furious with Rolf for his decision to go public. Only once did he speak about his involvement in the Mengele affair. Interviewed by a reporter from the New York Times, who had spent all day outside his home, Sedlmeyer was at his intemperate worst. "Well, naturally I knew, because I got a letter from the Bossets. My wife stupidly kept it. Stupid. I don't know why she did, but that's what got us in the end. They came here and found it. I could tell you what Mengele did, what he did during Auschwitz, what he did after Auschwitz, but you wouldn't believe me. The newspaper won't print the truth because it's not in the interests of the Jews. I'm sorry you came all this way for nothing, but I refuse to talk about the Mengele affair. Journalists have already written so many lies, and what the Jewish press has asserted." As the Times reported, Sedlmeyer did not finish the sentence, apparently out of exasperation. Many Gunzburg residents seemed to share his sentiments. A British camera crew was ordered by the police to move away from Dieter's home.
"Leave us in peace," another man shouted at them.
The local paper gave precisely 2 paragraphs on an inside page to its most notorious native son. As for the Mengeles,
they remain skeptical of the more horrendous charges against Josef. Rolf, his late brother Alois, and Sedlmeier had offered Mengele the chance to prove that he had been badly wronged. "Write down all that happened at Auschwitz," they told him. But Mengele's answer was always the same. If found by the police, the manuscript would give his identity away. Dissatisfied with these evasive replies, Karl Heinz had sought out the answer for himself 3 years after Mengele died. At Sedlmeier's suggestion, in December 1982, Karl Heinz visited Dr. Hans Munch, one of his uncle's former friends at Auschwitz, to ask him for his version of what went on there. Dr. Munch was a young SS lieutenant at a biological research station in an Auschwitz subcamp when he met Mengele. He told Karl Heinz that, yes, his uncle had been involved with gas chamber selections, but had he ever killed anyone with his bare hands? "Unlikely," said Dr. Munch, since camp discipline was so strict. Had he ever conducted experiments? That depended on what kind of experiments. The odd spinal tap or injection his uncle could very well have performed, but autopsies on purposely killed twins? Electric shock experiments? Connecting the blood supplies of twins? "Unlikely," said Dr. Munch, and, at any rate, he never saw for himself. And so, some rationalization had been going on among the Gunzbergers. It was important to be, in their view, objective about an extermination camp. That is why Dieter told John Martin in his ABC interview that he thought some of the allegations against Mengele had been exaggerated. Rolf explained, "It was important to the family that my father had not been involved in the act of killing with his own hands. They were not so concerned about him being a little cog in a big machine like Auschwitz, because it was the war, and in their view, those things happened." To Rolf, just his father's presence at Auschwitz was unforgivable. To the rest of the Mengeles, it was a distasteful function that he could not avoid. Today, the two Mengele factions do not speak, irreconcilably divided over their judgments of Josef's crimes. But what of Rolf himself? He has never quite resolved his feelings for his father. For there are still many inconsistencies in Rolf's role. He said he regards Auschwitz as abhorrent, but kept silent about his father because of the damage to the family that a trial would have caused. And yet the lasting damage to his family, now that the truth about their collaboration is out, has been greater still. "If he was guilty, I advised my father to give himself up," said Rolf. "Not at the beginning, because he wouldn't have gotten a fair trial, but later he should have." But a trial was what Rolf, by his silence, had worked so hard to avoid. History will correctly judge as morally obscene the Gunzbergers' attempts to rationalize their uncle's presence at Auschwitz. But Rolf somehow cannot yet bring himself to believe his father was a fiend. He never even considered changing his name. "It didn't matter that much to me, but I will probably change it for the sake of my children," he said. And that is puzzling too. For although the West German prosecutor's office compiled an arrest warrant setting forth his crimes in all their grotesque and minute detail, Rolf, the lawyer, demands yet more proof. He still wants the debate his father refused to engage in. That is why Rolf has been beating his breast in a public way, a subconscious penance perhaps for what his father did, its magnitude only dawning on him with the revelation of his death. The life, times, and death of Josef Mengele were a squalid business from beginning to end. And what an ignominious end it was! On June 21st, 1985, his bones, his skull, his bits and pieces were paraded before an eager audience on the 20th floor of the Sao Paulo police headquarters. It all matched up. The broken left finger, the height 174 centimeters, a telltale gap between his two upper front teeth. In one corner of the room, His skull was displayed. In another, a discussion was taking place about his degenerating spine. "This was present in the lower part of the column," said one specialist, pointing to his crumbling vertebrae. Elsewhere, a doctor was trying to make a point about Mengele's hip. "We see here a montage of the hip bones," he said. "I want to show you what we found." And so on. "Is there any doubt at all, Dr. Levine, that this is Josef Mengele?" asked John Martin of ABC News. "Absolutely not," replied the forensic odontologist from New York. For the sake of the civilized world's peace of mind, these scientists had performed one worthwhile experiment on an unworthy life. This concludes Mengele by Gerald Posner and John Ware. Narrated by Bruce Mann. Copyright 1986 by Gerald L. Posner and John Ware. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Gerald L. Posner and John Ware, care of Avitus Creative Management, LLC, and was produced in the year 2020 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.